Friday there, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, folks, you have found us again. I am Cam Hale, and as always, sitting across the table from me, in a fist fight with his headphone cord, is Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm so glad to be here.
Did it win? It looked like the cord was winning over there for
Man,
a second.
Man, it was all tangled up. I swear, I think fae folk come in here and, like, you know, they braid horses' manes.
Yeah.
They come in here and tangle up my headphone cables. You should see the nest of cables underneath this panel.
We're lucky we didn't have a fire. I mean, it's one of those things that I keep expecting a fire to break out.
Well, seriously, there's like at least 600 different wires underneath this panel if you lift this up. It's ridiculous. I mean, it is.
We always say we're going to do something about it, folks, but we don't.
You know how much work? It's out of control. Hey, on Thursday's show, on the Elite Show, you were talking about how Russian and Korean scientists were actually recreating mammoths. Now, we've been talking about them doing such a thing for a long time, but now they actually are doing it.
Yeah, the cloning, yeah.
And you were mentioning about how, that woolly mammoths were basically just big hairy elephants, and they were alive not too long ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had mentioned a number like 5,600 years. Well, I found this recent article, and you were 100% right.
Check out the big brain on
right.
me.
I was doing a little fact-checking on you, and I was reading, and I was like, holy crap, Cam was 100% accurate. Check this out. This comes from the BBC News.
Well, before you go, we had recently believed, I think it was 13,000 years was how recent that they were up around Siberia or whatnot, was what people were saying. I believe is what the most recent times were. And then now they found this.
Yeah, this is even more recent than we thought. Yeah. This is an article written by Rebecca Morrell over there. She's a science correspondent for the BBC News. And it's about how the last woolly mammoths actually died of thirst.
Oh,
now, they
dang.
Said one of the last groups of woolly mammoths died out because of the lack of drinking water, is what scientists now believe. The Ice Age beasts were living on a remote island off the coast of Alaska. And scientists have dated their demise to about 5,600 years ago.
Ooh, check me out.
Right? But so that's not that long ago. 5,600 years is not very long ago.
It's not long.
They believe that the warming climate actually caused lakes to become shallower, leaving the animals unable to quench their thirst.
Oh, man.
Most of the world's woolly mammoths died out on the rest of the world about 10,500 years ago. Scientists believe that human hunting and environmental changes played a role in their extinction. But the group that were living on St. Paul Island, which is located in the Bering Sea, managed to cling on for survival for another 5,000 years. Now, this study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests that these animals faced different threat from their mainland cousins. As the Earth warmed up after the Ice Age, sea levels rose, causing the mammoth's island home to actually shrink in size, also cutting them off from the mainland. This meant that some of the lakes were lost to the ocean, and as salt water flowed into the remaining reservoirs, fresh water diminished further. The fur-covered giants were forced to share their ever-scarcer watering holes, but their overuse also caused them a major problem. Now, a lead author professor, a guy named Russell Graham from the Pennsylvania State University, he went on to say that as the lakes dried up, these animals congregated around these watering holes, and as they were milling around, they were actually destroying all the vegetation around the watering holes, and we see this same pattern happening with modern elephants. All of this allows for the erosion of sediments to actually fall in the lake, which is actually creating less and less fresh water as time goes on. The mammoths basically were contributing to their own demise. And a man named Love Dahlin, who works for the Swedish Museum of Natural History, he said that if there was not enough rain or melting snow to top the lakes up, the animals may have died out very quickly. We do know that modern elephants require between 70 and 200 liters of water a day.
Mm.
We assume that mammoths did the same thing. It wouldn't have taken long if the watering holes had dried up. Even if it only dried up for a month, it could have been fatal. Now, researchers claim that climate change, of course, is happening today, and there could be similar impacts on small animals that live on these small islands with the threat of fresh water also disappearing. I mean, we've talked about it before. You've seen the Maldives.
Yes.
The water's rising so fast there that they know that, like, another 50 years, that country won't even exist.
Yeah,
it'll be underwater.
Gone. Yeah.
It'll be a modern version of Atlantis.
That's pretty wild.
Pretty crazy.
It's pretty wild, though. That wasn't that long ago.
The last mammoths on planet Earth were secluded on this very small island 5,600 years ago, and they died of thirst.
Like I said,
because of the rising ocean.
That's terrible.
Yeah, that's
a terrible, terrible thing. Well, I got something. We'll kind of pick it up. It was kind of bad there. We'll bring it back up because it's been bad in the past. This comes from Bruce Brown over at Yahoo, and he wrote this. And this is what caught my eye because there's something else I'm going to discuss right after this little segment here, this little article. But this is what's going on about Chernobyl the nuclear exclusion zone there in Chernobyl, okay?
Yeah.
And even what he writes here, he says, what do you do with land that's been rendered uninhabitable by humans, right?
Right.
What do you do with it? Well, the Ukrainian government decided the best use for what's 16,000 square mile exclusion zone that surrounds Chernobyl nuclear power station, the former one, of course.
Yeah.
You know what they're going to do?
No.
They're going to build the world's largest solar power plant.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's what they're doing. It says the solar energy plant plans are ambitious and on a fast timetable. The Ukraine government is currently negotiating with four Canadian energy firms and two U.S. investment companies, according to the Ukraine's ecology minister, Ostap Semirak. And it says the government is pushing for a six-month construction schedule to build a gigawatt hour solar plant is what they're working for.
Okay.
Now, this information comes from Electrek, but it says it would be the largest in the world if it was completed today. Others in similar capacity are already in the planning stages elsewhere. So they're racing to make them that big. But it says that because Chernobyl was a site for energy production in its former capacity, transmission lines already exist.
Right, and mutant animals.
Exactly. Now, Semirak says this, that the Chernobyl site has really good potential for renewable energy. We already have high-voltage transmission lines that were previously used for the nuclear stations. The land is very cheap, and we have many people trained to work at power plants. Says, as long as environmental and banking concerns are addressed, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development indicated it would be interested in participating. Now, it does say this, that after the 1986 meltdown of Chernobyl, 31 reactor staff and emergency workers died.
Yeah.
And that the total rose to 64 deaths attributed to this disaster by 2008. Now, the estimates of the eventual total deaths by cancer from excessive radiation exposure during and in the aftermath of the meltdown range from 4,000 by the Chernobyl Forum to Greenpeace has it around 100,000 people.
Man, that much.
Yeah.
See, and on the last show, I was talking about the power plant up in upstate New York,
yes,
just 35 miles north of New York City, that is falling apart,
yeah,
and doesn't have
meltdown.
Relicenser, hasn't been licensed again. And, I mean, what if something like that could happen? It happened at Fukushima. It happened at Chernobyl. I mean, this is a real thing. It could happen again. How terrifying is that?
Well, and they go on to talk about that. It says there's 700 people still live in the small villages in and around that area that was home to 14,000 people in the city. But they said now it's just a ghost town. But they did say this, that the fast-track timetable, once the project begins, if it does, that Electrek raised a valid concern about whether workers involved in the solar plant construction would, one, have to wear radiation suits.
Yeah.
And two, that if they did, they would have shortened work days and weeks to limit the exposure. But that's not what I was going to talk to you about. That was interesting when they were talking about the solar. But here's what's really wild. DigitalTrends.com actually did this story a while back. I want to say it's a month or so ago when they first started talking about this. But I was keeping up with it because it's taking place in Plano, Texas. Toyota.
What kind of people live in Plano, Texas?
Just Plano people live up there. Just Plano people.
Right.
Toyota is going to move their North American headquarters from California to Plano next year.
I gotcha.
Now, it says that they're hoping to take advantage of this move, that the Japanese carmaker plans to install a 7.75 megawatt solar power system at its new headquarters. It says the system is expected to take care of 25% of the Toyota campus's power needs.
See?
It would be, of course, now
why
that's.
Why are we not doing this?
Well, you got to be careful around here because of the hailstorms. But, I mean, but still, you'd think that they could come up with something that would probably be better. But this right here, it says Toyota also claims it will be the largest solar installation at a corporate office in Texas that isn't part of a utility company. And then, of course, they give the breakdown. But they believe that they could have it, they're going to come online with it in a year. August 2017 is when they're going to bring it online. They said by December of that year that Toyota hopes to add more panels and a third parking structure producing about 2.83 megawatts of power.
That's awesome, man. I mean, they can make bulletproof glass. They can make solar panels that don't get hurt by hailstones.
I'm sure it's. Well, and I think that that's what's wild is they're going to lead this. This is something that we need to start looking at because of all the areas in the U.S. that you really can't live on or that you really, you know, it's hard, you can't really farm or anything like that. I always think about people, if the government had some sort of subsidy, some sort of way that they could lay it out to farmers to go, all that land you can't farm.
Right.
We don't want you wasting water trying to irrigate it. You know, we don't, that's too precious. we'll give you a tax break and a percentage, and we'll let you have the electricity and all that stuff, but we're going to come and cover that whole area of your farmland with solar panels, and then we'll even teach you and your family how to fix those things. So we'll hire you. No more, you know, farming. If you want to farm, that'll be on you, but we'll hire you to help take care of some of these solar panels, and then that in turn is going to provide power for massive amounts of towns, because there's a bunch of small towns out in Texas that if you laid solar panels out around there, it would power them completely.
Oh,
you would have
absolutely.
No issue with it anymore.
You ever drive to El Paso, or you ever be up there by like Level Land and stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, dude.
Van Horn. You could lay enough solar panels out around Van Horn to power all of that town completely.
Absolutely. Yeah. On like two houses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
and then you get into the wind gen and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, speaking of technology and stuff, this comes from Chris Fox over the technology section of BBC. And it's about how Australia is planning on fixing these coordinates for their satellite navigation gap. I was unaware of this.
They got a problem with some satellite problems over there.
Yeah, with their automatic mapping. They're talking about like as the future is progressing very fast, we're going to have self-driving cars soon, like within the next decade, most likely. I mean, the Teslas already have them.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's going to be really mainstream. Well, the problem is those cars rely on GPS to navigate to drive around. Well, problem that Australia is having that a lot of other countries aren't having is this has to do with plate tectonics, okay?
And you're talking over my head now.
You know, like the moving plates of the Earth's crust.
Yeah.
And it's actually moving a few centimeters every year. So when they came up with the last GPS software, I guess that was like 8-10 years ago. Well, now it's off by like a couple meters.
Oh, that can't be. Yeah, that's not
so
a good
they know
thing.
That they have to fix this. So
yeah.
Australia is about to shift its longitude and latitude to address a gap between local coordinates and those from global navigation satellite systems. Their local coordinates used to produce maps and measurements, and the global ones differ by more than 1 meter. Now, the body responsible for in charge said it would help the development for self-driving cars, which need accurate location data to navigate. Australia moves about 7 centimeters north every year because of tectonic movements. Modern satellite systems provide location data based on global lines of longitude and latitude, which do not move even if the continents of the Earth shift. However, many countries produce maps and measurements with the lines of longitude and latitude fixed to their local continent. It says if the lines are fixed, you can put a mark on the ground, measure its coordinate, and it will be the same coordinate in 20 years, like when people are doing land surveying. But it's different, explained Dan Jaska of the Geoscience of Australia. It's the classical way of doing it, because the movement of the Earth's tectonic plates, these local coordinates drift apart from the Earth's global coordinates over time. If you want to start using driverless cars, accurate map information is fundamental. He said, we already have tractors in Australia that are starting to go around farms without a driver. And if the information about the farm doesn't line up with the coordinates coming out of the navigation system, well, then there's going to be problems. Now, the geocentric datum of Australia and the country's local coordinate system was last updated in 1994. And since then, Australia has moved about 1.5 meters north. So, on the 1st of January 2017, the country's local coordinates will also be shifted further north by about 1.8 meters. The correction over time means that Australia's local coordinates and the Earth's global coordinates will align again in 2020. At that point, there should be a new system in place that'll take into account changes over time, and then that'll be implemented. So they're going to jump ahead. They're actually going to sort of like now say there's an intersection with your global positioning system. Well, it's going to be off by 1.7 meters. So instead of correcting it to the true coordinate, they're going to move it ahead of it a whole other meter, 1.8 meters. That way, between now and 2020, which is how long it'll take.
It'll cover that cushion.
That should give us enough time to create software that'll take into account the moving. That's what they're hoping. I guess if it doesn't work, then
gamble.
You just move it again. But this is a problem.
And
this
car stops in the middle of an intersection.
This is really a problem I never really thought of. I mean, I've drive down the road all the time, and I've looked on things on Google Maps. It never even occurred to me that what if the plates that we're on are actually moving? Is there anything taking those measurements into consideration?
And that answer would be no.
I guess not. And then also, you know, it only points out Australia. There's got to be other countries that are having a similar problem. I mean, maybe other, based on what plate you're on, may not move as fast or may move much slower. But apparently Australia, the plate it's on, is probably moving the fastest. That's why this article was written. But that's a neat problem that I never knew was even happening. So pretty cool.
Yes. It's, man, it's one of those things that it's like we always talk about. Little bitty things lead to big things. It's one of those deals you never think of. You're like, all right, I got self-driving cars. But you don't think of all the stuff you got to do to prepare to release them to keep them that safe. Yeah, they're safe, but they're only as safe as the computer system driving them. And if that's any kind of gap like what you're talking about, you know what, though? I don't think the Australians would have a problem with it. Those guys seem like they're pretty fearless. Those guys would be like, it'll be all right. You know, let's give it a whirl and see what happens.
Right.
You know,
can you imagine in a world, say, 10, 12 years from now when 90% of the cars are driverless, what would happen if like a solar flare hit and all those cars all over the world immediately lost control? Because, I mean, solar flares are real. They do happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Well, not just that. I'm thinking about, though, even, let's say not just the amount of loss of life. If they all just, let's just say they all just shut down right there. Well, then if there's not a lot of vehicles that are gas powered anymore, if those are all off the planet, well, then we're back to bicycles.
I'm okay with the cars being electric, but I don't know if I like the driverless. I still think I like to be in control, regardless of what kind of fuel I'm running.
Nah, hell with it. Gamble a little bit.
Can you imagine in the future, looking back, people are going to be like, can you believe these jerk-offs used to actually drive their own car?
Yeah, right.
Like, how stupid is that?
Yeah, right.
Like, what?
It's like everything else. It's handy.
It won't even have a steering wheel in it. You'll just get in this cube and it'll look like a booth like at a restaurant. You just kind of sit around.
Just tell you where to go.
And it just takes you to work. Yeah.
Exactly.
Pretty cool.
I pulled this down here off of Lon's Phantoms and Monsters. He had posted this back whenever Mr. Pilatus was on Coast to Coast. Said there was a fella had called in when he was the guest on there, and he was talking. David was talking about his book, The Hunters, The Missing 411, that we talked about on a Thursday show some. Well, this guy calls in, Eric, what he's talking to him about is, apparently in David's book, there's a story called The Predator Story, in which a woman claims to have seen a predator-like creature in the forest. You know, you and I have always talked about this.
Yes.
He said she likened it to seeing saran wrap moving. He says, what you were describing tonight, especially the woman, and this is what Eric was saying, especially the woman saying she's seeing something that looked like it was wrapped in saran wrap, that's something that I had seen in the urban city back in the early 90s. He says, I was sitting in a car with an older friend of mine, and I looked up, and I looked at a tree, and it looked distorted, you know, in the tree. My friend was looking at it, too. He says, and I told my friend, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And he says, I'm looking at the one on the left. That's when I realized that there was two of them, and when they focused their vision on us, that they had most bloodshot, red, glowing type eyes. But the one thing I noticed was that they noticed us, and it was almost like I could understand what they were saying to each other, and they were in amazement that we were actually able to see them. So Eric goes on to say, so long story short, we darted out of there as fast as we could. I mean, it was just our reaction. Said it scared the hell out of us, you know, out of our minds. Says, I talked to somebody a couple of years later, an older guy in the neighborhood about it, and he said, oh, you guys see the tree people. A lot of people for years have been seeing those people around here. They don't have a shape to them, and they usually are when people just see them. Said it's people in the neighborhood. They just disappear around that time. Hmm. When the people of the neighborhood see the tree people, the people that see them have basically vanished.
Wow.
So that's what so maybe it goes into that. Well, then he goes on here saying that Jason in Missouri called in to tell of an experience when David was on. And said, I called to talk to David, you know, and all this stuff he's talking about. He goes, I don't think David would remember him. He talked about him about a year or so before this. But Jason says this, I had gotten lost. I was deer hunting, and I got about 10 miles deep in the woods. And I was in Everton, Missouri, and the woods are really thick back there. The woods went dead, just like David had reported what happened to him. And I felt something watching me. And the best way I can describe it is like if anybody has ever been through a tornado, you know that drop in the temperature that you feel, that's what it felt like. He says that I started walking, and as I was walking, I sensed something was watching me, like it was mimicking my steps. So I thought, I'll take a step and act like I'm going to step through and see if whatever's following me takes a step. He says, and I didn't step down, and I heard the crunch. I turned around, and nothing was there. He says, anyway, what I seen in the woods that night was, well, it was really crazy. I saw some garden gnomes, concrete garden gnomes, 10 miles out into the woods, and I was just wanting to see if David had ever seen any strange occurrences at a scene like that. It was really crazy, and I know it sounds crazy, but these garden gnomes were 10 miles out in the woods, and I remember that I sat down with my bag up against a tree, a big tree, because it had said it really scared me. I wanted to feel safe, you know, basically. And he said, I had the feeling, I don't know, but I had the feeling that something wanted to hurt me. And then I waited it out probably for 10 or 15 minutes. And like the rest of the forest came to life. Animals started going around again. And then I immediately darted as fast as I could up the mountain. And I was listening for a highway. And that's when I got out of there.
Hmm.
So we've talked about those silent spots where people say, you know, you don't hear anything. It just goes dead. People talk about it when they hear them in time slips. There's no sound. There's no, just for a second, it blends over there. And like we've talked about too, when you see predators in the woods, other animals, insects, everything will go quiet. Lots of stuff. It's strange sometimes the way the world, the way the woods work.
Yeah, we were talking about it on Thursday's Elite Show. Yeah.
So maybe they're seeing the same thing. And I love the fact that the guy's discussing tree people, what the people in the neighborhood see. And it's like, oh, well, heck, you know, you've seen the tree people. And this other guy says, garden gnomes 10 miles out. We're like, well, what are they doing out there?
Right.
So who knows, man? It's just some crazy stories in the woods.
After the break, I'm going to get into one of the most tragic journeys of all time, where a family was forced to endure the unthinkable, a journey filled with death, disease, and even cannibalism. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. On April 16th, 1846, nine covered wagons left Springfield, Illinois, on the 2,500-mile journey to California, in what would become one of the greatest tragedies in the history of westward migration. The originator of this group was a man named James Fraser Reed, an Illinois businessman eager to build a greater fortune in the rich land of California. Reed also hoped that his wife, Margaret, who suffered from terrible headaches, might improve in the coastal climate. Reed had recently read the book, The Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California, by Lansford W. Hastings, who advertised a new shortcut across the Great Basin. This new route enticed travelers by advertising that it would save the pioneers 350 to 400 miles on easy terrain. However, what was not known by Reed was that the Hastings route had never actually been tested. Written by Hastings, who had visions of building an empire at Sutter's Fort, now modern-day Sacramento, it was this falsified information that would lead to the doom of the Donner Party. Reed soon found others seeking adventure and fortune in the vast West, including the Donner family, the Graves, the Breens, the Murphys, the Eddies, the McCutcheons, the Kessbergs, and the Wolffingers, as well as seven teamsters and a number of bachelors. The initial group included 32 men, women, and children. With James and Margaret Reed, with their four children, Virginia, Patty, James, and Thomas, as well as Margaret's 70-year-old mother, Sarah Keyes, and two hired servants, they headed out. Though Sarah Keyes was so sick with the consumption that she could barely walk, she was unwilling to be separated from her only daughter. James Reed was determined his family would not suffer on the long journey, as his wagon was an extravagant two-story affair with a built-in iron stove, spring-cushioned seats, and bunks for sleeping. Taking eight oxen to pull these luxurious wagons, Reed's 12-year-old daughter Virginia dubbed it the Pioneer Palace Car. In nine brand-new wagons, the group estimated the trip would take 4 months to cross the plains, deserts, mountain ranges, and rivers in their quest for California. Their first destination was Independence, Missouri, which was the main jumping-off point for the Oregon and California trails. Also in the group were the families of George and Jacob Donner. George Donner was a successful 62-year-old farmer who had migrated five times before settling in Springfield, Illinois. Along with his brother, Jacob, obviously adventurous, the brothers decided to make one last trip to California, which unfortunately would be their last. With George were his third wife, Tamzine, their three children, Francis, Georgia, and Eliza, and George's two daughters from a previous marriage, Elitha and Leanna. Jacob Donner and his wife, Elizabeth, brought their five children, George, Mary, Isaac, Samuel, and Lewis, as well as Miss Donner's two children from a previous marriage, Solomon and William Hook. Also, along with them were two teamsters, Noah James and Samuel Shoemaker, as well as a friend named John Denton. In the bottom of Jacob Donner's saddlebag was a copy of Lansford's Immigrant's Guide, and with its tantalizing talk of a faster route to the Promised Land. Ironically, on the very day that the Illinois party started west from Springfield, Lansford Hastings himself prepared to head east from California to see what the shortcut he had written about was really like. The wagon train reached Independence, Missouri, about 3 weeks later, where they were resupplied. The next day, May 12, 1846, they headed west again in the middle of a thunderstorm. A week later, they joined a large wagon train captained by Colonel William H. Russell that was camped on Indian Creek about 100 miles west of Independence. Along the entire journey, others would join the group until its size numbered now 87. On May 25th, the train was held for several days by high water at the Big Blue River near present-day Marysville, Kansas. It was here that the train would experience its first death, when Sarah Keyes died and was buried next to the river.
We pray to thee, our God, this day for the blessings you provide. But from ashes to ashes and from dust to dust, so it must be. But keep this woman, O King of Kings, beneath thy almighty wings. O God, the spirit of all our joys, the cause of our delights.
After building ferries to cross the water, the party was on their way again, following the Platte River for the next month. Along the way, William Russell resigned as the captain of the wagon train, and the position was assumed by a man named William Boggs. Encountering few problems along the trail, the pioneers reached Fort Laramie just 1 week behind schedule on June 27, 1846. At Fort Laramie, James Reed ran into an old friend from Illinois by the name of James Clyman, who had just traveled the new route eastwardly with Lansford Hastings. Clyman advised Reed not to take the Hastings route, stating that the road was barely passable on foot and would be impossible with wagons. Also, warning him of the Great Desert and the Sierra Nevadas, though he strongly suggested that the party take the regular wagon trail rather than this new false route, Reed would later ignore his warning in an attempt to reach their destination more quickly. Joined by other wagons in Fort Laramie, the pioneers were met by a man carrying a letter from Lansford W. Hastings at the Continental Divide on July 11th. The letter stated that Hastings would meet the immigrants at Fort Bridger and lead them on his cutoff, which passed south of the Great Salt Lake, instead of detouring northwest via Fort Hall, which is present-day Pocatello, Idaho. The letter successfully allayed any fears that the party might have regarding the Hastings cutoff. On July 19th, the wagon train arrived at the Little Sandy River in present-day Wyoming, where the trail parted into two routes, the northerly known route and the untested Hastings cutoff. Here, the train split, with the majority of the large caravan taking the safer route. The group preferring the Hastings route elected George Donner as their captain and soon began the southerly route, reaching Fort Bridger on July 28th. However, upon their arrival at Fort Bridger, no word of Lansford Hastings was around. There was no sign. Only a note left with other immigrants resting at the fort. The note indicated that Hastings had left with another group and that later travelers should follow and catch up. Jim Bridger and his partner, Luis Vasquez, assured the Donner Party that the Hastings cutoff was a good route. Satisfied, the immigrants rested for a few days at the fort, making repairs to their wagons and preparing for the rest of what they thought would be a 7-week-long journey. On July 31st, the party left Fort Bridger, joined by the McCutcheon family. The group now numbered 74 people in 20 wagons, and for the first week, they made good progress, around 10 to 12 miles per day. On August 6th, the party reached the Weber River after having passed through Echo Canyon. Here they came to a halt when they found a note from Hastings advising them not to follow him down Weber Canyon, as it was virtually impassable, but rather to take another trail through the Salt Basin. While the party camped near modern-day Hennifer, Utah, James Reed, along with two other men, forged ahead on horses to catch up with Hastings. Finding the party at the south shore of the Great Salt Lake, Hastings accompanied Reed partway back to the point to point out a new route, which he said would take them about 1 week to travel. In the meantime, the Graves family caught up with the Donner Party, which now numbered 87 people in 23 wagons. Taking a vote among the party members, the group decided to try the new trail rather than backtracking back to Fort Bridger. On August 11th, the wagon train began the arduous journey through the Wasatch Mountains, clearing trees and other obstructions along the new path of their journey. In the beginning, the wagon train was lucky to make even 2 miles per day, taking 6 days just to travel 8 miles. Along the way, they discovered that some of their wagons would have to be abandoned before long. Morale began to sink, and the pioneers began to adamantly blame Lansford Hastings. By the time they reached the shore, they also blamed James Reed. On August 25th, the caravan lost another member, one Luke Holleran, who died of consumption near present-day Grantsville, Utah. About this time, fear began to set in as provisions were starting to run low and time was against them. In the 21 days since reaching the Weber River, they had only moved just 36 miles. 5 days later, on August 30th, the group began to cross the Great Salt Lake Desert, believing the trek would take only 2 days, according to Hastings. However, what they didn't know was that the desert sand was moist and deep, and their wagons quickly got bogged down, severely slowing their progress. On the third day in the desert, their water supply was nearly exhausted, and some of Reed's oxen ran away. When they finally reached the end of the grueling desert 5 days later, on September 4th, the immigrants rested near the base of Pilot Peak for several days. On their 80-mile journey through the Salt Lake Desert, they had lost a total of 32 oxen. Reed was forced to abandon two of his wagons, and the Donners, as well as a man named Lewis Kessberg, lost one wagon each. On the far side of the desert, an inventory of food was taken and found to be less than adequate for the 600-mile trek still ahead. Ominously, snow powdered the mountain peaks that very night. They reached the Humboldt River on September 26th. Realizing that the difficult journey through the mountains and the desert had depleted their supplies, two of the young men traveling with the party William McCutcheon, and Charles Stanton were sent ahead to Souter's Fort, California, to bring back supplies. From September 10th through the 25th, the party followed the trail into Nevada, around the Ruby Mountains, finally reaching the Humboldt River on September 26th. It was here that the new trail met up with Hastings' original path. Having traveled an extra 125 miles through the strenuous mountain terrain and dry desert, the disillusioned party's resentment of Hastings and ultimately Reed was increased tremendously. The Donner Party soon reached the junction with the California Trail, about 7 miles west of present-day Elko, Nevada, and spent the next 2 weeks traveling along the Humboldt River. As the disillusionment of the party increased, tempers began to flare in the group. On October 5th, at Iron Point, two wagons became entangled, and John Snyder, a teamster of one of the wagons, began to whip his oxen. Infuriated by the teamster's treatment of the oxen, James Reed ordered the man to stop, and when he wouldn't, Reed grabbed his knife and stabbed the teamster in the stomach, killing him. The Donner Party wasted no time in administering their own justice. Though member Louis Kessberg favored hanging James Reed, the group instead voted to banish him. Leaving his family, Reed was last seen riding off into the west with a man named Walter Heron. The Donner Party continued to travel along the Humboldt River, with the remaining draft animals exhausted. To spare the animals, everyone who could walked. 2 days after the Snyder killing, on October 7th, Louis Kessberg turned out a Belgian man named Hardcoop, who had been traveling with him. The old man, who couldn't keep up with the rest of the party with his severely swollen feet, began to knock on the other wagon doors, but no one would let him in.
Please! I won't be any trouble. I can't walk. Please! For the love of God, please let me in.
He was last seen, sitting under a large sagebrush, completely exhausted, unable to walk, worn out, and was left there to die. The terrible ordeals of the caravan continued to mount, when on October 12th, their oxen were attacked by Paiute Indians, killing 21 of them with poison-tipped arrows, further depleting the draft animals they had. Continuing to encounter multiple obstacles, on October 16th, they reached the gateway to the Sierra Nevada on the Truckee River, almost completely depleted of food supplies. Miraculously, just 3 days later, on October 19th, one of the men the party had sent on to Fort Souter, Charles Stanton, returned laden with 7 mules loaded with beef and flour, 2 Indian guides, and news of a clear but difficult path through the Sierra Nevada. Stanton's partner, William McCutcheon, had fallen ill and remained at the fort. The caravan camped for 5 days, 50 miles from the summit, resting their oxen for this final push. The decision to delay their departure was yet one more of many that would lead to their tragedy. October 28th, an exhausted James Reed arrived at Souter's Fort, where he met William McCutcheon, now recovered, and the two men began preparations to go back for their families. In the meantime, while the wagon train continued to the base of the summit, George Donner's wagon axle broke, and he fell behind the rest of the party. 22 people, consisting of the Donner family and their hired men, stayed behind while the wagon was repaired. Unfortunately, while cutting timber for a new axle, a chisel slipped and Donner cut his hand badly, causing the group to fall further behind. As the rest of the party continued to what is now known as Donner's Lake, snow began to fall. Stanton and the 2 Indians who were traveling ahead made it as far as the summit but could not go any further. Hopeless, they retraced their steps, where 5 feet of new snow had already fallen. with the Sierra Pass just 12 miles beyond. The wagon train, after attempting to make the pass through the heavy snow, finally retreated to the eastern end of the lake, where level ground and timber was abundant. At the lake stood one existing cabin, and realizing they were stranded, the group built two more cabins, sheltering 59 people, in hopes that the early snow would melt, allowing them to continue their travels. The 22 people, with the Donners, were about 6 miles behind at Alder Creek. Hastily, as the snow continued, the party built three shelters from tents, quilts, buffalo robes, and brush to protect themselves from the harsh conditions. At Donner Lake, two more attempts were made to get over the pass in 20 feet of snow, until they finally realized they were snowbound for the entire winter. More small cabins were constructed, many of which were shared by more than one family. The weather and their hopes were not to improve. Over the next 4 months, the remaining men, women, and children would huddle together in cabins, makeshift lean-tos, and tents. Meanwhile, Reed and McCutcheon had headed back up into the mountains, attempting to rescue their stranded companions. 2 days after they started out, it began to rain. As the elevation increased, the rain turned to snow, and 12 miles from the summit, the pair could go no further. Cacheting their provisions in Bear Valley, they returned to Souter's Fort, hoping to recruit more men and supplies for the rescue. However, the Mexican War had drawn away the able-bodied men, forcing any further rescue attempts to wait. Not knowing how many cattle the immigrants had lost, the men believed that the party would have enough meat to last them at least a couple of months. On Thanksgiving, it began to snow again, and the pioneers at Donner Lake killed the last of their oxen for food on November 29th. The very next day, 5 more feet of snow fell, and they knew that any plans for a departure were dashed. Many of their animals, including Souter's mules, had wandered off into the storms, and their bodies were now lost under the snow. A few days later, their last few cattle were slaughtered for food, and the party began eating boiled hides, twigs, bones, and even bark. Some of the men tried to hunt with little success. And on December 15th, Bayless Williams died of malnutrition, and the group realized that something had to be done before they all died. The next day, 5 men, 9 women, and 1 child departed on snowshoes for the summit, determined to travel the 100 miles to Souter's Fort. However, with only meager rations and already weak from hunger, the group faced a challenging ordeal. On the 6th day, their food ran out, and for the next 3 days, no one ate while they traveled through grueling high winds and freezing weather. One member of the party, Charles Stanton, snowblind and exhausted, was unable to keep up with the rest of the party, and they told him to go on. He never rejoined the group. A few days later, the party was caught in a blizzard and had great difficulty getting and keeping a fire lit. Antonio, Patrick Dolan, Franklin Graves, and Lemuel Murphy soon died, and in desperation, the others resorted to cannibalism. Living off the bodies of those that died along the path to Souter's Fort, the snowshoeing survivors were reduced to 7 by the time they reached safety on the western side of the mountains on January 19th, 1847. Only 2 of the 10 men survived, including William Eddy and William Foster. But all 5 women lived through the journey. Of the 8 dead, 7 had been cannibalized. Immediately, messages were dispatched to neighboring settlements as area residents rallied to save the rest of the Donner party. On February 5th, the first relief party of 7 men left Johnson's Ranch, and the second, headed by James Reed, left 2 days later. On February 19th, the first party reached the lake, finding what appeared to be a deserted camp, until the ghostly figure of a woman appeared. 12 of the immigrants were dead, and of the 48 remaining, many had gone crazy or were barely clinging to life. However, the nightmare was by no means over. Not everyone could be taken out at one time, and since no pack animals could be brought in, few food supplies were brought in. The first relief party soon left with 23 refugees, but during the party's travels back to Souter's Fort, two more children died. En route, down the mountains, the first relief party met the second relief party coming the opposite way, and the Reed family was reunited after 5 months. On March 1st, the second relief party finally arrived at the lake, finding grisly evidence of cannibalism. The next day, they arrived at Alder Creek to find that the Donners had also resorted to cannibalism. On March 3rd, Reed left the camp with 17 of the starving immigrants, but just 2 days later, they were caught in another blizzard. When it cleared, Isaac Donner had died, and most of the refugees were too weak to travel. Reed and another rescuer, Hiram Miller, took three of the refugees with them, hoping to find food they had stored on the way up. The rest of the pioneers stayed at what would become known as Starved Camp. On March 12th, the third relief, led by William Eddy and William Foster, reached Starved Camp, where Miss Graves and her son Franklin had also died. The three bodies, including that of Isaac Donner, had been cannibalized. The next day, they arrived at the lake to find that both of their sons had died. On March 14th, they arrived at the Alder Creek camp to find George Donner was dying from an infection in the hand that he had injured months before. His wife, Tamzine, though in comparatively good health, refused to leave him, sending her three little girls without her. The relief party soon departed with four more members of the party, leaving those who were too weak to travel. Two rescuers, Jean-Baptiste Trudeau and Nicholas Clark, were left behind to care for the Donners, but soon abandoned them to catch up with the relief party. A fourth rescue party set out in late March, but were soon stranded in a blinding snowstorm for several days. On April 17th, the relief party reached the camps to find only Louis Kessberg alive among the mutilated remains of his former companions. Kessberg was the last member of the Donner Party to arrive at Souter's Fort on April 29th. It took 2 months and four relief parties to rescue the entire surviving Donner Party. In the Donner Party tragedy, two-thirds of the men in the party perished, while two-thirds of the women and children lived. 41 individuals died, and 46 survived. In the end, five had died before reaching the mountains. 35 perished either at the mountain camps or trying to cross the mountains, and one died just after reaching the valley. Many of those who survived lost toes due to frostbite. The story of the Donner tragedy quickly spread across the country. Newspapers printed letters and diaries and accused the travelers of bad conduct, cannibalism, and even murder. The surviving members had differing viewpoints, biases, and recollections as to what actually happened, and was never extremely clear. Some blamed the power-hungry Lansford W. Hastings for the tragedy, while others blamed James Reed for not heeding Kleiman's warnings about the deadly route. After the publicity, immigration to California fell off sharply, and Hastings' cutoff was all but abandoned. Then, in January 1848, gold was discovered at John Souter's mill in Coloma, and gold-hungry travelers began to rush out west once again. By late 1849, more than 100,000 people had come to California in search of gold near the streams and canyons where the Donner Party had suffered. Donner Lake, named for the party, is today a popular mountain resort near Truckee, California, and the Donner Camp has been designated as a National Historic Landmark. The Donner Camp has been the site of many archaeological excavations. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed that chilling story. Cam, are you getting ready for the Olympics? I know you're a big Summer Olympics guy. It's going to be taking place in Brazil. Are you getting excited?
There's certain sports, of course. Like, I have to get up in the middle of the night to watch archery. Yeah, and then, of course, I'll watch the wrestling and things like that. I'm kind of torn about this whole deal now, you know, because it used to be a big deal for me because whenever we were kids, you know, it was only on like one or two channels when we were real young, real little kids, and it was the thing. And now every four years seemed like forever. Yeah, and now you got to just bounce around to find it in the whole thing. And I know what people are thinking. We want to hear about the fishing trip. We know you went down to the coast and all that stuff. If you're listening to this, folks, I'm still down there. We're doing a little early pre-recording right now, so I'll talk about it when I get back on the next Monday show. We'll bring it back up again, so you'll be able to, of course, you elite listeners, I'll be able to talk to you all again on Thursday. But right now I'm time traveling, people.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. But man, I don't know. It doesn't hold the allure it used to hold to me when I was a kid, I think.
Well, what bums me out the most is the sport that they cut. The oldest sport in the Olympics is the one that they cut
this
out.
This is the last year for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they'll be cutting out the wrestling.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. Of course, you and I have talked about it. I would love to see them turn it into submission grappling, no-gi, submission grappling.
Awesome.
You don't call it jiu-jitsu or anything. Just catch wrestling, submission grappling. I would love to see it turned into that in a sport where everybody could still go and train and all that stuff. But, Philly, I got something to tell you.
Sure.
This past episode on the Elite Show, you know, we talked about what Florida man went into. Well, apparently there's some other nonsense going on down in Dunedin, Florida. And I hope I pronounced that right. Dunedin, Florida.
Sounds good.
There's a video online of a boomerang-shaped UFO.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this comes from, of course, Open Minds over there. And Roger reported on this. Now, it's testimony case. You ready? 41685 there in the MUFON. But it's about 200 to 300 feet across with three other objects, it says, close by. Now, you watch the video. It's strange the way these lights are. Look, I can't tell, you know, exactly what it is, but the way the lights are set, it does give it the appearance of something large. But it says the witness and two others were southbound along Keene Road, just north of Sunset Boulevard, about 8:40 p.m. on August 11th of 2012 when the incident occurred.
Okay.
Says the case was reported to MUFON on August 12th of 2012 and closed as an unknown. But the witness has this to say: we noticed a large group of lights heading towards us. There appeared to be four objects. The largest was at least 200 to 300 feet across the front and shaped like a boomerang with three or four lights that blinked and a constant light as well. Now, they described the other object, saying that the second object appeared to be in a very tight wingman position of the left wing of the first object, maybe 20 foot apart. And the third object looked like the second, with a bright silver strobe, red and green lights, which sounds like something that we fly around with,
right?
The same things we put on a boat,
yeah.
But not in the normal aviation layout, as you could see both red and green from the port side. The third object appeared to be tethered to the first and trailing about a half a mile with a single bright white silver strobe on the tether, located about a third of the way from the first object back to the third object in tow. Almost sounds like a refueling plane or something.
Yeah,
that's,
right.
That's the way it goes. And, of course, they filmed it with their cell phone, of course, pulled over, watched it. But it says this: that the first object released orbs from the bottom, and they shot west. These objects appeared to be orbs, but were very hard to see as they were a very dim white color and disappeared within 1 to 2 seconds of being launched. The object passed us to the west and headed north until approximately Klosterman Road, where it banked right or east, and headed toward an extremely large thunderstorm.
Wow.
Says, this is my second report, but have witnessed dozens of UFOs in the last 4 years. It goes back into the whole thing we talk about. The shape of them is what's unique to me.
It's changed, right?
It's beginning to change a little from the shape, but it's always the lights. The lights are the dead giveaway for me for it not being extraterrestrial.
I have to agree with
it
you.
It feels like it's something that we're not being.
Not that they couldn't, but it's just, why would they?
Well, if you can do all of that and fly through space and time and universes, why do you have to have safety lights flashing? Don't you think you got something on the aircraft that would allow you to not be seen by other things or to be able to evade them? Yeah, you don't need to be, and you're giving it away. But it almost seems like we always talk about, it's testing. It's aircraft testing.
Right. Back
of
in the
something
day,
we don't know.
Looks like flying saucers, and then it moved into triangle shaped, and now they all seem to be like the chevron shape.
Yes.
Or boomerang shaped.
Yes.
It's probably because it's something that we're testing.
Yes. That's the way it feels.
It's the way it feels to me.
I wish we knew. It drives me crazy, man. I wish we knew.
You're never going to know.
No, we're never going to know.
Yeah, pretty cool. Well, if you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with Expanded Perspectives, don't forget you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the show 817-945-3828. We really appreciate getting to read some of your encounters. We really enjoy that. Everybody out there, have a good week. If you're an elite member, we'll speak to you on Thursday. Hopefully Cam will be alive when he gets back from his fishing trip and a shark doesn't eat him. But I'm sure he'll be a little more sunburnt and be in good shape. Right, Cam?
I'm going to do my best.
All right. For Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition Books, New Page Books, Warwick & Associates, Llewellyn Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Keep your head above water, folks. Peace.